our primary objective is that Frankie. That is what we are struggling for, and we are actually fighting for our freedom. We are fighting for the people to understand that we will...
This call originates from a Louisiana correctional facility and may be recorded or monitored.
That we were framed for murder, that we are totally and completely and actually innocent of.
You have 15 seconds left on this call.
Let me call you back.
That was Albert Woodfox from the 2010 documentary In the Land of the Free. And that does it for our show. George Kendall and Robert King, thanks so much for being with us. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and an engagement editor. Find out more at democracynow.org, both full-time jobs. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Aaron Janier. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Gran, David Prude, and Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. That was Democracy Now!, and up next is the KBOO Evening News. But first, these important messages.
Join us for the KBOO Community Radio Monthly Film Night at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll be showing the film Death Metal Angola on Thursday, June 11th at 7 p.m. This documentary traces how death metal has taken root in the Southwest African country of Angola, with its history of war and civil unrest. Creating something new is an act of defiance in the face of destruction. Again, that's Death Metal Angola at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor for ALEC Expo's film screening and workshop on June 18th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. ALEC, the American Legislators Exchange Council, is a corporate-directed organization which writes model legislation for state legislatures around the nation that is beneficial to multinational corporations. Secretive corporate-directed and funded organizations like ALEC undermine the principles of citizens participating in democratic processes. ALEC Expose explains how ALEC functions, who is involved, and how to fight back to promote democratic, non-corporate values. Again, that's ALEC Expose, June 18th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, WikiLeaks has released another document connected to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this time revealing the effect of the agreement on healthcare.
Oregon Senator Mark Haas introduces a bill that would make community college virtually free for qualified high school students in Oregon.
And the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry has drafted proposed plans for the industrial area of Portland that would include apartments, condos, office buildings, and a 13-story hotel. Thank you.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 10th, 2015. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Portland State's newly elected student body president, Dana Ghazi, has asked the university's Board of Trustees to delay a vote on arming campus security that's scheduled to happen this Thursday. In a press release issued yesterday, Tuesday, June the 8th, the Associated Students of Portland State University Chief of Staff relayed Ghazi's doubts about rushing the plan to a vote during finals week. KBOO's Sarah Sweatoff spoke with Ghazi to get more details.
I'm here with Dana Ghazi, recently elected ASPSU student president. That's the Associated Students of Portland State University, the student government. Just yesterday, ASPSU issued a press release where you opposed the upcoming vote on deputization that's scheduled to happen this Thursday and asked for more time. Can you talk about your position and why you think this vote shouldn't happen right now?
Well, I think it shouldn't happen for several reasons. First of all, as the new coming administration, we feel like we've heard a lot from students, just being students ourselves, my vice president and I before, about how problematic this seems, or how there's a lot of tension around it. And it seems such a painful process because students have been trying to organize around it so much, yet it seems that it's they feel a little bit alienated because this is happening too fast, and especially that it's happening during finals week. So as the new coming administration, we would like to ask the board for more time so we can have the chance as the new administration to engage with students again and to hear back from them again and have the time to have them have their say again, because it's happening during a time where students are really busy. They're not able to be present even for, you know, some of those meetings or sign up to be there. So if we can have more time, hopefully we can discuss with the board this, we can discuss this with the board more deeply and get more engaged with it.
So this debate about the arming of campus security has been going on for a little bit more than a year now, but there have been many student complaints about the process itself. What is the background to this current upcoming scheduled vote?
Well, the thing is, it's the vote on passing the resolution on deputizing the campus security has already passed. The implementation is really kind of a continuous process to that, so it's not separate from that. So students have been, what they've been trying to say is that, okay, if this is how it's going to happen anyway, let's, you know, talk about ways in which we can control, like, or maybe have an oversight over how they're going to be armed and they're going to conduct the security issues around campus and things like that. But what David and I are trying to say is that it's still that whole issue of having arms on campus is problematic by itself, and we want to try to see if, you know, if students can bring that voice and or that organization to actually reopen the discussion, maybe in a way, or have the alternative presented and explore that. So the background around it is that it's pretty much has been decided despite the students really opposing it and organizing around it. So we'll see. If we delay, we might have still a chance to reopen that discussion and revisit it and actually maybe have another chance at it.
So you referred to David, who's David Martinez, the current vice president, mm-hmm. and your running mate. And you all ran on a platform that explicitly opposed arming campus yes. security and yes. aimed to insert yourselves in the process exactly like how you're describing now, give students an opportunity to weigh in further.
Exactly. And we're both coming at it from several perspectives. First of all, we don't see how having an on campus is really targeting any of the issues around security. If it's about sexual harassment or sexual violence or any of that, that seems strange to think about it as like something that needs force to combat. Because the way I see it is that it needs a lot of education around it, right? It needs to change. You need to change a whole culture of thinking. And we are in a cultural setting. We are in an educational setting. That should be our priority, right? I mean, there are a lot of things we can do around changing the culture around sexual harassment and violence. Actually, some students said that they might be less likely to report any of those incidents because they would fear escalating violence. Another point is that if the campus, the PSU vision, the administrative vision, is to diversify the PSU campus. However, if we're going to talk about diversifying, and what they mean by that is specifically, I think, racially diversifying the campus. But however, if that's going to happen, well, a lot of students of color have came out like in clear opposition to this army plan because of the tension and the issues around, you know, feeling marginalized and feeling targeted by police in general and things like that, like feeling that tension around the presence of police on campus. So it seems to me that we need to pay more attention to those voices in particular. If the administration is truly honest about like wanting to diversify the campus, then this seems like a priority to actually listen to the voices of students of color and other marginalized students.
That was KBOO's Sarah Swetsoff speaking with Dana Ghazi, president of Portland State University's student government, about the pending deputization of campus security at PSU.
A bill passed Oregon legislature Tuesday that made it easier for law enforcement to confiscate firearms from convicted domestic abusers and people under restraining orders. The bill was proposed in an effort to protect victims of domestic abuse and those who file restraining orders. Representative Carla Peluso, a Gresham Democrat, explains restraining orders alone do not always ensure the safety of victims, and adding a weapon to the situation increases the risk of homicide. Opponents of the bill claimed the bill put police in unnecessary danger as it could invite a firefight. Other opponents claim the bill is redundant as there is an existing federal law already covering the issue. Here's audio from the Oregon Senate floor discussing the bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm the Attorney General for Oregon, and I come to you today in support of Senate Bill 525, and I want to thank our senators who have already spoken for their support of this bill. As Attorney General, I administer all parts of the Department of Justice, but I have a particular soft spot for the Crime Victim Services Division, which acts as the primary agency administering the grants and services upon which crime victims rely in their time of greatest need. This division also tracks many of the national issues which most significantly impact the victims of crime. And it is in this capacity that I come before you today to talk about the clear and unacceptable connection between gun violence and domestic abuse. In an average year, around 20% of all homicides are related to domestic violence. Approximately 2/3 of those homicides involve the use of a firearm. Nationwide, the risk of homicide is 20 times higher in homes where there is both an established history of domestic violence and ready access to guns. Domestic violence assaults with guns are 12 times more likely to be fatal than assaults without guns. But this tells only part of the story. Research shows that domestic abusers who possess guns tend to use them as part of their pattern of abuse, as a ready threat of further violence, and as a tool for psychological control and mistreatment. The domestic violence fatality statistics are shocking, but they cannot be allowed to overshadow the struggles of those who live under the constant shadow of firearm-related violence against themselves and their children. Federal law recognizes this danger by prohibiting individuals convicted of certain crimes of domestic violence or subject to qualifying restraining orders that have been upheld after a hearing from possessing guns and ammunition. Unfortunately, these federal protections are not codified in Oregon law. This means that Oregon courts have no specific statutory authority to implement these protections and no authority to hold abusers accountable for violations. Most concerning, victims in Oregon are left without the protection intended by the federal law. In the absence of local authority, the entire state of Oregon is left to rely on the 14 Oregon-based agents of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And while these agents do good work. It is simply unreasonable to expect this federal team, with many additional assignments, to shoulder this significant burden as well. Senate Bill 525B provides Oregon courts with the tools they need to protect the victims of domestic abuse and will provide state and local law enforcement with the power to enforce the prohibitions that up till now have only existed under federal law. I believe this bill represents a tremendous opportunity to protect the lives of the victims of domestic violence. I urge your support for Senate Bill 525B. Thank you.
Thank you.
The gun bill passed Oregon legislature on Tuesday with bipartisan support and is awaiting Governor Kate Brown's signature.
Otilia Iwana of Woodville Village has filed a lawsuit against her employer, which accuses her former employer of manipulating her job title to avoid overtime pay. Otilia worked at the Portland Airport Starbucks for a company called HMS Host Corporation. The company filed her as a management position, which, under company policies, disqualifies employees from overtime benefits. According to the lawsuit, Otilia's job duties were no different from regular hourly employees and that she had no authority to make policy. The lawsuit comes as the result of a class action lawsuit against the company by multiple employees. The judge ruled that the individual employees' duties varied too much and that each employee with a claim would need to file their own suit.
Oregon Senator Mark Haas has sponsored a bill that would make community college virtually free for qualified high school students in Oregon. The bill would allow students with a 2.5 GPA or higher to pay $50 per term while pursuing a certification or associate degree. Senator Haas hopes this will open up job opportunities within industries that are requiring more and more training prior to hiring. The Oregon Student Association and the Oregon Community College Association have both expressed concerns about the bill. They claim that it would be more beneficial to struggling students for the state to fully fund education and state-run financial aid programs. President Obama has advocated for similar approaches nationwide. The fate of this bill likely will be decided by the end of June or early July.
About a dozen cities, water quality and conservation groups have joined forces to challenge part of the new Department of Transportation bill about oil train safety. The rule is about how much information should be made public when crude oil or other flammable liquids are shipped by rail through an area. 2 years ago, an expose by the Oregonian newspaper found that the state was under no obligation to tell local authorities when potentially explosive loads of crude oil would be passing through their towns. This led to a campaign by environmental groups to make the information public. KBOO's Joe Aaron has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
New federal rules proposed for oil train safety don't do enough to ensure that emergency responders know when trains are coming through the area or what's on them. That's the premise of an administrative appeal to the Transportation Department by groups representing the health of the Columbia River all the way to the New York Hudson River. They're asking that the DOT keep previous notifications in place that they say were weakened in the final rules. Michael Lang with Friends of the Columbia Gorge says the goal may have been to thwart terrorists, but the result could make it harder for it to get information in the case of an emergency.
They significantly weaken the requirement to notify emergency responders to protect our communities. That wasn't even an option in the draft rule. We're asking the Department of Transportation to correct the error by reopening the process and allowing public comment.
The DOT says its new rules include notifications of local government agencies for what it terms as large volumes of flammable liquids. The rail companies have said releasing more route and cargo details could compromise national security, as well as letting competitors know too much about their business. Lang points out that if Tesoro Savage Terminal in Vancouver, Washington is approved, it would be the largest oil-by-rail terminal in the United States. So he says communities in the Columbia Gorge need to plan ahead.
All of the oil that would go to that terminal and all the other refineries and terminals in the Northwest goes right through the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. We don't think that's right. We don't think these communities should be placed at risk.
The law firm Earth Justice is representing the dozen groups. This is the latest in a long line of challenges to the new oil tank car safety rules that were announced in May. For KBOO News, I'm Joe Aaron.
The Oregon Senate has passed a bill that will allow for self-service fueling in some parts of Oregon. The bill is expected to receive unanimous approval in the House as some changes are reviewed. The new law will allow you to pump your own gas in small and rural communities where gas stations may not be able to afford employees to stay open later. In most states, motorists can simply swipe their credit card and pump gas by themselves 24 hours a day, regardless of whether there is an attendant. Oregon and New Jersey are currently the only states that require attendants pump gas.
Low levels of ice melt and stream flows in Oregon have led to the earliest release of water to the Tualatin River on record. The temperatures ranging from 5 to 10 degrees above average for this time of year, Clean Water Services have had to adjust their summer plans for keeping the Tualatin River flowing. During a normal summer, the Clean Water Service releases about 25 million gallons of water a day into the Tualatin River to maintain water levels. This water is normally released between the months of June and September. However, for the first time in 20 years, they will be starting almost a month early. The increased demand will require that the available water is rationed out to make sure that it lasts the entire summer. The Tualatin River gained attention in 1989 when it became the first river in the state to fail pollution tests that were enacted in the 1972 Clean Water Act. The river has a very slow elevation drop over a lot of its length, which can lead to stagnancy when water levels are low. Approximately 35% of the land the river goes through is agricultural and depends on clean, fresh water from the river for crops.
Solar World America has been served with a lawsuit alleging that its treatment of transgendered workers was discriminatory. Solar World America operates in Hillsboro and is the largest solar panel manufacturer in the United States. An investigation into the company by the Bureau of Labor and Industry found that gender identity did not affect advancement or hiring opportunities. But the report did find that the company failed to address complaints made by transgender employees. The majority of the lawsuit centers around the company's handling of restroom usage and bullying by coworkers.
The Oregon Museum of Science and Industry wants to change the way you see the industrial district. The nonprofit group has drafted proposed plans for the industrial area of Portland that would include apartments, condos, office buildings, and a 13-story hotel. The changes have caught the attention of business owners in the area. Many of the companies that call the area home are concerned that development may push them out of the last industrial haven in Portland. Business owners are concerned that a shift in the real estate market will raise the cost of property in the area and will bring complaints from new tenants about the noise and smell of the area. Supporters of the plan argue that the industrial section of town offers fewer jobs per acre of land, as there may be only 4 employees at a business that takes up substantial space. Howard Shapiro, the city planning commissioner, holds that he does not immediately support the plan, but would like to leave the option to develop the area for the future.
The decision takes effect in about 22 days.
Back in 2000.
To the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview, followed by Right to Survive on at 6. On tonight's show, we'll hear about recent efforts for water justice in Michigan. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area is cloudy early, becoming mostly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 79. Winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Today in history, on June 10, 1957, the Progressive Conservative Party, led by John Diefenbaker, won a plurality of the seats in the Canadian House of Commons in the federal election, bringing an end to 22 years of Liberal Party rule. The quote of the day comes from Elbert Hubbard. Don't take life too seriously. You'll never get out of it alive.
It's 5:23, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Back in 2008, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein declared, "There are parts of government that can be run like a business and should be run like a business." Thus, the chairwoman of the Senate Committee overseeing congressional facilities privatized the restaurants and other food services in the U.S. Senate. Sure enough, those dining spots now turn a profit because they are being run like a business, specifically a business like McDonald's. Restaurant Associates, the New York outfit that got the House and Senate food contract, profits by paying poverty-level wages and generally mistreating the cooks, waitstaff, and other people who put the service in food service. Wages are less than $11 an hour, well below the very expensive cost of living in the Washington area. Everybody has second jobs, says one weary worker. And when our $174,000 a year members of Congress adjourn for the 3 months or so of vacations they take each year, the food service workers are sent away with no pay at all. I should note that Restaurant Associates did give a pay raise to some workers not long ago. It was 3 cents an hour. That's not a raise, it's an insult. I serve food to some of the most powerful people on earth, says a Senate cook. They often talk of expanded opportunity for workers, but most don't seem to notice or care that workers in their own building are struggling to survive. Care? A key Senate committee chairman, Representative Tom Graves, recently showed how much Congress cares about the inequality by refusing even to consider requiring food service contractors to pay a living wage. It's really not within the scope of this committee to micromanage all contracts, he sniffed. This is Jim Hightower saying, think of how that makes the Capitol dining staff feel. If I was old Tom, from now on, I wouldn't eat anywhere in the Capitol without taking a food taster with me.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A new law in Maryland is the first in the nation to protect the social media privacy rights of students. The law makes it illegal for universities in the state to demand or require access to students' social media accounts. But it still allows the institutions to access information that students share on university-owned networks. It also grants colleges and universities protection from legal liability over students' online actions. The original bill included high school and elementary school students as well, but the final version included only colleges and universities. Maryland was also the first state to grant similar protections to business employees in 2013. Another 18 states have adopted similar legislation since then.
Now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Joanne Powers. Auto parts workers in impoverished Cleveland, Mississippi scored a victory Monday, voting overwhelmingly to form a union. Workers at the France-based Faurecia Automotive Seating Plant faced low wages and poor working conditions, as well as a company practice of hiring even lower-paid temporary contract workers. They will now be represented by the United Auto Workers, who have been following a strategy of aggressively organizing workers across several southern states. The Women's Media Center has released its fourth annual report on the status of women in the U.S. media. Unsurprisingly, the extensive compilation of studies found that women are very underrepresented across all types of media, ranging from film to television, from print to digital media, with both news and entertainment still dominated by male voices and male perspectives. Geneva Overholser is a member of the WMC Board of Directors.
The media gender gap continues year after year to be quite lamentably strong. It's a really large gap. Simply speaking, pretty generally, women are about a third in most of the media. This new report shows us who matters and what is important to media, and clearly, as of right now, it's not women. Particularly disturbing is the absence of women of color.
Overholser says the lack of diversity in newsrooms across the nation becomes even more lamentable in light of the 2016 presidential race, particularly with much media attention focusing on a prominent female candidate.
Women really need to be in that debate. Not that all women are going to be fair, but I think fairness in coverage is affected by whether or not women are equally represented in the political reporting ranks.
With a corruption scandal facing FIFA, the governing body of world soccer, the Middle Eastern nation of Qatar is at risk of losing rights to host the 2022 World Cup tournament over new attention focused on worker deaths. Estimates are that over 1,200 immigrant workers, primarily from Nepal and India, have died due to unsafe working and living conditions while building stadiums for the event. The workers suffer slave-like conditions and are not allowed to leave Qatar without an exit visa.
Workers Independent News would like to improve our coverage of the low-wage worker movement. For more information on that campaign and how you can help, Google Indiegogo, Raise the Wage. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers and from the United Auto Workers.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by Ulico. For more than 85 years, Ulico has been protecting union workers with quality, affordable insurance while responsibly investing union funds to create jobs and achieve respectable returns. More information is available online at ulico.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
WikiLeaks released another document connected to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this time revealing its effect on the healthcare system. According to Public Citizen, the leak reveals the TPP would subject Medicare to strict procedural rules to the benefit of pharmaceutical companies. The leaked document outlines not only sections that would affect the U.S. healthcare system, but every country involved in the trade agreement, especially developing countries. KBOO reporter Catherine Maticek spoke with Peter Mybarduk, director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines program, about the leaked document.
I'm speaking with Peter Mybarduk, director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines program, about the most recent leak of the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement.
Very good to be here with you today. What we have here is, so the TPP has about 30 chapters, and only a few of them have been leaked. So we still don't know much about the bulk of the agreement, except we have an idea of many of the subjects that they're covering. But in the leaks that we've seen, among other things, an attack on our healthcare systems sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies. So this particular leak, it's the second time we've seen an iteration of these proposals. It shows us, well, fortunately, the Obama administration is undermining its own proposals to reform our healthcare system that they've made in other contexts. If these policies are enacted in this, if we sign these rules into this trade agreement, we'll actually be tying our own Congress's hands and preventing our ability to reduce the cost of cancer medicines more quickly in some areas and negotiate drug prices effectively in others. There are a number of rules in an intellectual property chapter and in this annex on procedural fairness in healthcare technologies that give pharmaceutical companies more rights to, in one case, exclude generic competition or keep their products on patent or otherwise monopoly protected for a longer period of time. And in another context, limit the interventions that governments can make to list or not list a pharmaceutical product for reimbursement and change the procedural rules for some of those programs. So Medicare would actually be subject to these procedural rules. That's expressly in this new leak. And the rules are really designed to attack similar programs in Australia and New Zealand.
So across the board, this also affects other countries' medical programs and prices.
It's most serious for developing countries that are quite resource constrained. Public health dollars are limited. Treatments are very expensive. That leads to rationing of care and preventable suffering and death. People do not get the access to medicines that they need when we allow the monopoly rules to go unchecked and when we don't sort of negotiate effectively with pharmaceutical companies, because unfortunately companies find that they make the most money selling at high prices to the few instead of at low prices to the many. It's largely about the drug companies trying to change the rules in other countries and doing what they can to exclude competition in those countries. And for those countries, it will be deadly.
So basically, the benefits come only to the pharmaceutical company?
Well, that's definitely true in the case of this annex. I mean, this annex is largely buy-in for the pharmaceutical companies, the content of today's leak. For the past dozen years or so, the pharmaceutical giants had been pressing New Zealand and Australia to change aspects of their pharmaceutical reimbursement systems, and this is sort of the manifestation of that, or one manifestation of that. But of course, we're concerned that we might see some reach-through effects, some dangers for Medicare today, and certainly for the sort of reforms we'd like to see enacted in the United States in the future.
Do you think that this new leak will affect the TPP's chances of passing Congress?
Well, it's hard to say. It's going to be very, well, so, I mean, the most important vote is on fast track, right? Trade Promotion Authority coming right up, maybe as soon as Friday. And that's going to be a very close vote, and every last vote counts. So hopefully there'll be a few undecided members out there who might have a look at this and see that we're undermining our own healthcare system potentially with this agreement, even as we hurt people in developing countries, and decide, you know, that's really not worth it. I'm not going to vote for fast.
That was Peter Marbaduke, Director of Public Citizens Global Access to Medicines Program, discussing the medical aspect of the recent leak of the TPP. This is Catherine Maticek with KBOO News.
6 days after police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris with promises of relocation, nearly 200, mostly Eritreans and Sudanese, are still homeless and living in the streets. Earlier this week, police violently dispersed the group from a public square and detained about 85 people. French human rights officials are currently investigating. As Raphael Kraft reports, many migrants are stuck in a cycle of detention and release with nowhere to go.
Chanting solidarity with refugees, hundreds of people rallied Tuesday evening in northern Paris in support of mostly Eritrean and Sudanese migrants who were violently detained by anti-riot police Monday afternoon. The approximately 85 refugees were among hundreds evicted from their ad hoc compound beneath an overpass last week. One local woman, Ms. Daragon, arrived at the demonstration with a rolling bag filled with almost 45 pounds of grilled chicken to distribute to the nearly 200 migrants who are still sleeping outside.
I came here to demonstrate once again because I'm fed up with this crappy government who is only able to expel people.
Daragon had donated tents, sleeping bags and clothes that were all destroyed last week when officials raised the migrant camp. About 50 of the people detained Monday were identified and released. Another 20 were sent to two detention centers where they faced deportation proceedings. On Tuesday, Jacques Toubon, the French Defender of Rights, an independent and constitutional institution that defends citizens' rights, opened an investigation of police violence against migrants the day before. And while Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo expressed support for a migrant aid center, she has not yet taken official action to provide shelter or assistance. Raphael Kraft, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, June 10th, 2015. Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Israeli tanks invade areas in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian man on Wednesday at dawn during an invasion targeting the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank district of Jenin. Medical sources in Jenin said that the soldiers fired several rounds of live ammunition at Izzeddin Ben Gafara in his 20s, directly hitting him in the chest, causing instant death. The soldiers also fired rounds of live ammunition, gas bombs and rubber-coated metal bullets, in addition to similar flares during clashes that took place with local youth. Many Palestinians also suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation after the soldiers fired tear gas bombs into their homes. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday morning 8 dunums around 2 acres of farmlands in Al-Isawiyya town in occupied East Jerusalem, demolished several structures and uprooted fruit and olive trees. The Palestinian landowners who are losing their lands point out that the Israeli confiscation of their lands is part of the larger E1 settlement plan that is aimed at the illegally confiscation of large areas of Palestinian lands to complete the chain of illegal settlements around Jerusalem and the subsequent prevention of any Palestinian geographical contiguity. In related news, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Wednesday 2 Palestinian children in Al-Isawiyya town in occupied East Jerusalem and 18-year-old in the northern West Bank district of Nablus. The army also demolished a residential tent in Hebron, southern West Bank. In the Gaza Strip, several armored Israeli military vehicles and bulldozers conducted on Wednesday morning a limited invasion into Palestinian agricultural land east of the Al-Qarara town, northwest of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Eyewitnesses said that 3 armored bulldozers and 4 tanks left the Kisufim military base across the border fence and advanced approximately 200 meters into the farmlands. Military drones were also flying overhead while the invading soldiers fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition to force the Palestinian farmers out of their lands. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, June 10th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
The relatives of 2 Yemeni men killed by U.S. drone strikes have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government. They claim that the U.S. military violated the rules of international engagement when they wrongfully killed the 2 men. They seek no compensation, but hope to bring attention to the hundreds of civilians who've been killed by the U.S. military's secret drone program. One of those killed is a Muslim cleric who took a stand against Al-Qaeda in Yemen. The other was a Yemeni police officer and brother-in-law of that cleric. The U.S. military has in the past year faced increasing accusations of working with known al-Qaeda fighters in both Yemen and Syria. The international human rights organization Reprieve is assisting with the lawsuit against the U.S. military.
The New York Times reports today on the growing use of U.S. courts to try people accused of crimes that have no connection to the United States. Several trials of people charged with waging jihad were highlighted by the paper. The trials include people who were not targeting the U.S., were not U.S. citizens, did not take place on U.S. soil, and that had never set foot in the U.S. prior to being extradited to this country. Some of the people involved charged that they were taken into custody, tortured or beaten at the direction of FBI officers, interrogated overseas, and then blindfolded and put on a plane to the U.S. The article notes that from the period between 2001 and 2011, over half of those charged with waging jihad were not U.S. citizens, although they were tried in U.S. courts. The phenomenon is also on display in the FIFA trials, in which officials of the International Football Association have been arrested and extradited to stand trial in U.S. courts. The issue at hand is the increased assertion of U.S. jurisdiction around the world. Lawyers for the charged cite the fact that the accused, quote, had no idea that they were subjecting themselves to U.S. law when they undertook any activities of which they are charged, end quote. A ruling by the U.S. Court of Appeals in 2011 states that criminal conduct need not be country-specific, in that anyone who violates the law must know that they are in danger of being put on trial anywhere for their actions. The ruling follows action by the U.S. Congress in 2004, in which extraterritorial jurisdiction for terrorism was broadly expanded. Broad language in the bill requires that an individual only be brought into the U.S. for them to be eligible to stand trial in this country.
In an ironic twist made possible by the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court, a well-known anti-whaling group will be making a large payment to a Japanese whaling group. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and its founder, Paul Watson, have agreed to pay $2.55 million in a settlement to Japan's Institute of Cetacean Research, also known as ICR. The payout is related to an injunction issued by the Ninth Circuit Court in 2012, which stated that the Sea Shepherd's U.S. operations must remain at least 500 yards away from Japanese whaling ships while in the Southern Ocean. The Southern Ocean is considered to be an international waters and thus traditionally believed to fall under international court jurisdiction. A Sea Shepherd U.S. ship was transferred to the Sea Shepherd Netherlands, which later used the ship in actions to protect whales from Japanese vessels in the Southern Ocean. The Ninth Court ruled that this constituted a violation of the injunction. The payment will come from a legal defense fund and will result in all claims against Paul Watson, founder and former head of the Sea Shepherd Board of Directors, being dropped by the ICR. The International Court of Justice has ruled that the ICR's research whaling was illegal and was intended to harvest whale meat for sale on the international market. The ruling resulted in a one-year moratorium being placed on whale hunting in the Southern Ocean by the Japanese government. That moratorium did not apply to other Japanese whaling efforts, such as the northwestern Pacific Ocean. Japan also announced a new whaling season for the Pacific, which begins tomorrow and is scheduled to run through late August.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jimmy Tardy, Catherine Maticek, Sarah Swetsoff, and Joe Aaron. The producer is Galen Sanford. Special thanks to our engineer, Jimmy Tardy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO...